Hers was one of the most distinctive voices of the mid-20th century. High and clear, with a flute-like resonance, the voice of Eleanor Roosevelt was most often raised in defense of the weak and oppressed, raised in calls for justice and compassion, and also in the hope that universal brotherhood would someday prevail. Her life, with its origins in a Victorian world of chaste restraint, became a bold odyssey into the deepest, most contentious currents of domestic and international political waters. As both activist and author, her words and works remain vivid 4 decades after her passing. My guest is Alida Black, project director and editor of the Eleanor Roosevelt Papers at George Washington University. Alida, welcome to Dialogue.
Oh, thank you, George. I'm thrilled to be here.
I am thrilled to have you here because we're discussing someone I admired all my life. And let's begin with a kind of an overall impression of her, Alida, if we may, at least one that I'll offer, and then you can revise and extend or correct altogether.
Sure. But
it seems to me, first of all, that she had so many callings, and this makes her distinctive. First of all, she's remembered as First Lady, United Nations delegate, Democratic Party leader, columnist, social activist, and educator. And so I guess, Alida, I ask you for your reaction to that, and my sense that all of that taken together makes her truly remarkable among American leaders, men or women.
Well, I agree. I mean, I would say that Eleanor Roosevelt was one of the three most important leaders of the 20th century. And I think that her amazing ability to wear all of those hats, if you will, concurrently is just amazing. But if I could be parochial for a minute, as a history teacher, I would say that there's a common thread that runs through all of that, and that Eleanor started out as a history teacher.
Uh-huh.
And that's what she loved. And she was a voracious, almost like a sponge, if you will, not only about American history, but the history of different cultures and nations around the world. And that helped shape her personality. And it also gave her the courage to struggle because she felt like that she was in the company of people who were engaged in constant struggle.
That's a remarkable insight. I had never known that she had a background as a history teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say, for all of these reasons and others perhaps besides, that she's an example of personal growth? Throughout her entire career?
She's the personification of it. Mm-hmm. And that's why working on Eleanor is never boring.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a person, she's fascinating because she continually has to reinvent herself, if you will, not in as somebody phony trying to get a sense of who she is, but, you know, she's orphaned. So where does she fit in after that?
Right.
She goes to Allenswood, a school in London. She blossoms. She becomes happy. She loves it. She doesn't want to come home. She comes home. You know, she has to make her debut. How does that fit with everything? She marries, so then she redefines herself again.
Mm-hmm.
Then when FDR becomes president, there's this whole thing about, well, do I want to be first lady? No. But how can I do this in a way that gives credence to my independence and my political beliefs as well as supporting him?
Well,
so she does that. And then, if I could just finish one more point, and when he dies, you know, she reinvents herself again.
Well, I think that the word reinvention is very well taken here. And let me try this on you in that same context. As I, just reading about her through your good collection of her political writings and some other things, came also to this conclusion that she was consistently discomforted with complacency.
I mean, absolutely.
That was the one thing, or at least one of the things, that she simply could not accept.
I mean, she felt complacency was almost an immoral position because it was counterproductive and very selfish. Eleanor would say, we are on trial to show what democracy means.
Mm-hmm.
And she believed that, not only in some great intellectual way, but down to the bottom of her soul.
Right.
I mean, for example, when she went to the Pacific in World War II, after pleading with FDR to let her go, and the only reason she was allowed to go was because of race riots that occurred in the United States for which she was held responsible. And she spends 18 to 20 hours a day on her feet, meeting with soldiers, seeing the wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And she carried a prayer with her then that she carried with her through the rest of her life
that
said, Dear Lord, help me to remember that somewhere someone died for me today.
Mm-hmm.
And help me to remember to ask, am I worth dying for? So how can you be complacent with that attitude?
Exactly. And it also is a reflection of not being complacent. She was, dare I say, adamant about the stands that she would take. And this, Alida, helps me introduce a subject I want us to discuss. We'll come back to. Because I think perhaps all first ladies, at least those who pronounce themselves, come in for a degree of this. Mm-hmm. But I think she's almost unprecedented in the degree of both reverence and controversy that she came in for.
Yes.
And so a comment from you on that would be helpful. But also, in light of this question, was it largely because her interests were so voluminous, her writings were so voluminous, and her stance were so adamant?
Well, I would say that there's never been a first lady that has been so revered and yet at the same time had this intractable reservoir of hatred directed toward her. I mean, Hillary Clinton, who I also have tremendous respect for, was certainly a lightning rod, but in a different sense. I think that Eleanor became a lightning rod for several reasons, not just because of the positions that she took, but because she took these positions. Mm-hmm. I mean, she came from a privileged class, from a different party, and then spoke out on behalf of the Democrats as opposed to the Republicans. And in the Democratic constituencies that she addressed the most were the constituencies that were the most controversial: labor, immigrants, African Americans, women, the rights of the disenfranchised. So Eleanor was really provocative for a whole lot of reasons, but her use of the media was incredibly skillful. Mm-hmm. And so she used the most traditional language possible to justify the most untraditional behavior.
Right.
I mean, she was a genius. Mm-hmm. It was like, you know, with her daily My Day column, if the press would attack her, well, man, she had an instantaneous form in which to respond the next day.
And respond she did.
Exactly.
And in responding, Alita, and I think this is brought up by what your comments just made, it seems to me that she did take up the cudgels for disenfranchised groups, unpopular groups, and unpopular
yes.
causes. And perhaps you gave us some insight into this aspect of her when you earlier said she was a history teacher. Because I was impressed as I read through the collection of political writings that you've edited of hers with a thematic consistency from the beginning to the end. For example, let's take African Americans. Going back to 1936, an address at the Urban League, mm-hmm. one of the first quoted pieces here, first included pieces here, at a time when the New Deal was almost brand new itself, mm-hmm. she's beginning to fight that fight, and she keeps that going
yes.
throughout her life.
And she doesn't come to race easily. In fact, how Eleanor becomes aware of racial injustice is really quite amazing. And she doesn't really get it, if you will, until 1934, when Walter White, who was then executive director of the NAACP, enlists her aid in the anti-lynching campaign. But it's a great issue by which to assess Eleanor's political judgment, because once she got it, she just stayed there like super glue. You know, you could not dislodge her from it. I mean, she was just, she was bonded, I mean, in a really emotional way. And by 1939, when you had the famous Marian Anderson concert, you know, on the Lincoln Memorial, she is saying things like, why curse Hitler and suppress Marian Anderson?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why curse Nazism and support Jim Crow?
Yeah.
And so she's really holding a mirror up. And the more she became exposed, the more she realized how timid we were as a nation. You know, by 1943, she's saying the white man's burden is something that we can no longer afford to have in this country, or we cannot afford to hide our secrets like skeletons in a closet, mm-hmm. and that race is the litmus test for democracy. Mm-hmm. So she was just incredibly intense in her support.
Absolutely.
In fact, the first decision that she makes after FDR dies is to join the board of directors of the NAACP.
Alita, there is a extended excerpt here. I call it a piece, but it's actually a chapter compilation of various parts of chapters of a book called The Moral Basis of Democracy. I'd never known that she wrote this. Is a little book she refers to here, published in 1940. Tell me a bit about that. Is that the essence of her philosophy, so to speak?
Well, I think it's the single most important book Eleanor wrote in terms of saying, this is what I believe and why I believe it. She very much believed that democracy was a spiritual calling and that it was a moral endeavor, not in the terms of I'm more moral than you are, but that if we were ever going to figure out how to survive great horrors and great disappointments and volatilities. We had to figure out a way to come together. And it doesn't matter to Eleanor whether it is Christ-centered or Buddha-centered, or whether it's tied to the Quran, or whether it's tied to Islam or Zionism or whatever. The point is that people realized that there was a spiritual calling for all of us to figure out how to live together. And that just as there was struggle in every religion, there is struggle in commitment to build a new world.
Right.
And so the moral basis of democracy, I mean, I just love it, because you get Eleanor being Jefferson, if you will, or being Mandela, if you will, but writing for an eighth grade level. I mean, anybody on the planet can understand this book. I mean, third graders can read it. And
use it as a primer, as I said.
Exactly.
Alita, I've got to ask you this question now, because this also has been, it was a part of our history. It's a part of a personal history, and of Eleanor Roosevelt's history, as well as our nation's. And I refer here to something that in our day does strike us as an extraordinary injustice. I'm referring to Japanese American internment.
Yes.
And given the fact that Eleanor Roosevelt spoke all of her life so powerfully against intolerance of all kinds, what do you make of her explanation, if not defense, or perhaps even defense, of that internment as included in this collection here?
I think that defense is a strong word. It's a complicated situation, and I'm not trying to whitewash Eleanor, because it is the major blot on her record. But this is what we do know, and I will say that I spent 2 years specifically working on this, so I, with a little bit of arrogance, can say that I know more about this than anybody on the planet. And when FDR began to propose internment, Eleanor was adamantly opposed to it. The day that FDR is bombed, Eleanor goes on the radio. In fact, if you go to the Smithsonian, you can hear it. When she pleads for tolerance and remembers that we are all Americans and that we cannot turn our hostility inward on one another, she flies to the West Coast, where she appears with Japanese Americans, you know, of a variety of political affiliations and incomes. She says that we must patently guard against blaming Japanese Americans for the acts of Japanese, because they are first and foremost Americans. She works with the Attorney General to oppose internment. She works with the military in Hawaii to get their attitudes to try to shape American policy. She goes to people in the Supreme Court and talks to William O. Douglas and tries to figure out constitutional arguments for it. She works with the American Civil Liberties Union. There is no doubt that Eleanor is opposed to internment, but when FDR signs executive order, a silence takes over her that is painful for her, and must be excruciating for her and very painful for us who love her. But she can't keep quiet for very long. She'll use languages, expressions in her columns such as, "It chills my soul to think of American children behind barbed wire." I mean, Eleanor never talks like that, so it really stands out in the columns. And she wants to visit the camps, but FDR refuses. And then in 1943, we have a series of huge riots in the Manzanar camp that breaks out and kind of spreads out to other facilities. And Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes telegraphs FDR and says, "We are hemorrhaging to death here. You know, send her. We need help." So Eleanor is in Phoenix visiting her daughter, Anna. The president calls her, asks her to go to the camps, and she spends 2 days in Gila River. Now, we don't know what she said inside Gila River, because those are very one-on-one discussions.
Right.
But we do know that she comes back out and she writes the article to which you refer, which has the strange title of In Defense of American Sportsmanship. But for every argument that she gives in that piece, George, she gives another one that kind of contradicts it. And so it's a great reflection of how torn she is. And she finally convinces FDR to change the policy later on.
So what we have here is a woman who did everything she could to oppose this, fought that fight for as long as she felt she could. Then when it became a matter of declared policy, had to make tortuous adjustments to a reality that you say she never liked or accepted.
Very much so. And this is so atypical Eleanor behavior, that the only thing that I think happened, and as a historian, you know, I can't say this with absolute certainty, But I think what probably happened is that the president said to her, Eleanor, on this you will not cross me.
And I can imagine him saying that. FDR's voice, if he said it, I guess you wouldn't cross him. Alida, let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Alida Black, editor of Courage in a Dangerous World, the Political Writings of Eleanor Roosevelt, published by University of Columbia Press.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now, let's turn to her finest hour, which I would nominate as being her chairmanship of the Drafting Committee for the United Nations, the Drafting Committee for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights on behalf of the United Nations. First question, Alida, what did it mean to her personally to chair a group like this? And let me, just by way of reference, point out that this included people like René Cassin of France, who would go on to be a Nobel Prize winner in his own right, Charles Malik of Lebanon, who would be Mr. Everything at the UN. Yes. I mean, these are powerhouses. And we haven't mentioned this, but she has had, I think, a lifelong issue with shyness, has she not?
Well, yes and no. I mean, she's shy in her personal life, but that doesn't mean that she doesn't know how to work the public. I mean, I think that a better word for this might be private, perhaps, as opposed to shy. But it truly is a remarkable event. My project has about 35,000 documents now that relate to Eleanor's role as chair of the drafting committee. And what we see here is a patience and a finesse and just a steely joy that she had here. And part of it is because, you know, she was so written off when she accepted this position, because Vandenberg and Dulles and Connolly and all the big boys, if you will, thought if they put her on committee three with social and cultural concerns that she'd be dealing with art.
Right.
You know, well, nobody thought that refugees would be sent to committee three, and that became the major issue of the post-war world.
Well, let's point out right now, I mean, I think what you're alluding to is very important. What you're suggesting here is the kind of domestic opposition she felt in even getting this post.
Oh, absolutely.
And let's add to that the international arena, lest we forget. In or about this time, the Cold War was beginning. Palestine was going up in flames for the first time. China would soon fall. I mean, we have a world literally in flames. We have a committee that's charged with producing a document about rights when rights are themselves a matter of very differing definitions throughout the world.
I mean, it's stunning if you think of this. The world does not share a singular concept of religion. The world does not share a singular concept of property or wages or family or government. I mean, and all of those are discussed in the Articles of the Declaration. And so what Eleanor was charged with doing was bringing people to the table and creating an atmosphere in which people could express their hopes and their fears and compromise, and compromise up. And that was her greatest contribution to the world, in the sense that Eleanor helped craft a new vision of hope in the midst of the greatest despair that the world had seen. And she did it in a way that brought people to the table who had never been at the table before.
You know, this whole subject set me to reading a book written by one of your colleagues, Marianne Glendon.
Oh, it's a wonderful, wonderful book.
Indeed it is, A World Made New, which documents this entire extraordinary story. You know, but one of the connections I can make from our conversation is that they set out, first of all, with this sort of massive philosophic survey of all the traditions of the world. You know, where will you find the sense of brotherhood in this or that tradition, to then begin to meld it? But I have a sense here, Alida, and maybe you can correct or inform this, that her ability to do that was informed by her very own religious sense, which you said earlier was kind of all-embracing.
Yes.
That she would be open to this just by...
Very much so. And she was fascinated by the sources of courage for people around the world. And so a lot of her private correspondence would be discussing matters of faith with different people, not in the sense of a searching, but tell me what you believe and why you believe it. For example, at the twilight of her UN service, if you will, in the winter of 1952, she goes around the world at the request of women of Japan and people in India and people in Indochina. And she spends months in India with Nehru. And part of this book that she writes about this trip is filled with her revelations, and well, that's the wrong word, her reveling in the different faiths of India, because she took such joy in learning where other people got their strength.
Right.
And she believed that we had to come together and not use faith as a way to divide people, but faith as a way to bring people together.
In other words, faith as a bond rather than as a kind of a systematic organization of hatreds.
Exactly. There was one of my students a couple of years ago when I was teaching class on the Roosevelts saw this cartoon that was in the New Yorker and brought it into class. And it was caricatures of all the religions of the world. And underneath it, it said, all God's children got guns, you know.
Yeah.
And my student's comment was, this is what Eleanor would say, you know, that we should use faith as a way to celebrate humanity rather than to slay it.
Because she believed that so strongly, Alita, both in her UN service and as you pointed out now, just thereafter, with what degree of personal anger or bitterness did she receive the fact that, A, the Eisenhower administration did not keep her on, and then, secondly, we, the United States, did not ratify the covenant that accompanied the declaration?
Yes. Well, she was bitterly disappointed that Eisenhower didn't keep her on. In fact, she did not submit her letter of resignation until New Year's Eve of 1952. I mean, talk about it, that, you know, at that, you know, the last possible moment. But in typical Eleanor fashion, you know, she thought, well, I can pout or I can get up and do something. And so she decides instead to donate a great amount of her frenetic energy, if you will, to the American Association for the United Nations, or the United Nations Association. And so she spent a lot of her time traveling and promoting the UN at home and around the world. Now, Eleanor was very disappointed that the covenants were never ratified in her lifetime.
By the way, these covenants would have given legal enforcement to the Declaration.
Yes, because the Declaration, I think the single most strategic decision that Eleanor makes while she's a member of the American delegation to the United Nations, is to separate the Declaration from the covenants.
Right.
Because she knew that if, in fact, this was going to have the binding force of law, then it would take forever to get through. And what she wanted in this narrow window of opportunity was to get the world together to create a new vision.
Right, a new mentality.
A new mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And to take this vision, if you will, or this new attitude into the world to encourage people to think for themselves, to organize for themselves, and to have the courage to dream.
Right. Alita, we mentioned, both of us in different ways earlier, the degree of both, you know, reverence and controversy, support and attack that she suffered. But I want to come back to that for a moment, because I think at that point you mentioned that in our own time we've seen, for example, Hillary Clinton become a subject of some similar controversy. But I think people have to appreciate how vitriolic it was. And there's a letter or exchange of letters in your collection referring to a fight or battle between her and Cardinal Spellman in New York City over the issue of public support for parochial education.
Yes.
And I must say, he, for his part, delivers one of the most intemperate and also ill-written letters that, that I think I've ever seen. But I mean, this was the kind of thing that must have been, you know, quite stunning.
Well, it was, a lot of people attacked Eleanor. I mean, Gerald L.K. Smith, who was a leader of the religious right in the 40s and the 50s, said, the only good thing that I can say about Eleanor Roosevelt is that she gave her old gold teeth to the Elk Lodge. And Cardinal Spellman was so incensed by Eleanor's opposition to federal aid to parochial schools that he instructed all of the priests in his parish to denounce her from the Sunday pulpits as an unfit mother. And so it was quite a national scandal, or a cause célèbre, if you will, so much so that ultimately the Pope got involved, and the Pope instructed Cardinal Spellman to apologize to Eleanor. And Eleanor got great glee from Cardinal Spellman calling her from a community that was about an hour and a half down the road, saying, "Oh, Mrs. Roosevelt, I'm in the neighborhood, and I thought if it was all right, I might drop by for tea," you know. And so he comes, and they had this sort of political rapprochement, but it's clear that Eleanor won. And so the next day in her column, she, you know, kind of tweaks him a little bit and said, well, you know, the Cardinal was kind enough to call on me today when he was in the neighborhood, although he had to drive an hour and a half to get here. so there's this little spearing that, you know, that goes on too. I mean, she enjoyed a good political fight. This one was not a saint.
I like that. The spirit, the wit, the feistiness, and mm-hmm. The good causes. Mm-hmm. And I guess, Alita, that really puts us right in the right place as we come to the conclusion of our conversation. Because of all of that, because of those qualities, all those fights, all that accomplishment, the obvious question is, how should we interpret her legacy now? Now, of course, that could take us into another, not just another conversation, but quite an extended series of them. But if you were to define it in one way, and let me just suggest at least one personal notion, this very universal Declaration of Rights, it seems to me it's gotten a rebirth, or maybe getting a rebirth now in this era of globalization. But you speak to the question.
Well, the Declaration certainly has become a model for more state governments and more constitutions around the world than our own Bill of Rights and our own Constitution. So that legacy is remarkable. But if I could be personal for a minute, I think Eleanor's greatest legacy is her ability to really believe in democracy despite daily evidence of its profound shortcomings. I mean, she really, she believed that we had a choice of being complacent or engagement. And complacency was just a cop-out. It was selfish behavior to Eleanor. And the last sentence that Eleanor Roosevelt wrote before she went into the hospital to die, other than a thank you note that she wrote while she was in the hospital, is this sentence. And I think it sums up her life in ways that are just too moving for me to really convey. And that is, staying aloof is not a solution. It is a cowardly evasion.
Well, thank you very much, Alita Black.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest today, Alita Black, her book, which I recommend to all listening, Courage in a Dangerous World, The Political Writings of Eleanor Roosevelt, edited by Alita and published by Columbia. Thanks again.
Thank you, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Alita Black. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Dale. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our assistant producer is Rachel Edmonds. And our production assistant is Thomas Hayes. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
To order a Dialogue program or for more information, contact us at 202-691-4146. Email us on America Online at radiodial@aol.com.